WSF 90.1 FM, and we hope you have a great Kwanzaa and a Happy New Year.
Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host for today. My name is Aaron Wang. I'm joined by my many co-hosts, Kira Tianen, Brandon Brownlee, and Hale Rottery. Today, I've selected for our topic, Moral Foundations Theory. Why did I select this for a topic? I was very naive. I thought, you know what? We need moral foundations for our show, for our society, and maybe this theory will help us understand what the moral foundation of our society is, that we live in Canada, and what it should be for this show. And then I read deeper about this, and I was like, you know what? This isn't normative. This is descriptive ethics. I think I've made a relatively major mistake. And then I was like, you know what? I know how to fix this. How I'm going to fix this is we're going to think about whether or not this theory. Actually, not whether. We're going to think about how this theory applies to Canadian society and our society. Do we have care-based ethics, fairness-based ethics, loyalty-based ethics? Or are we shaped by different foundations? So do we agree with these categories as good foundations for societies? And if we do think they are good categories, how are we going to, which one should have a priority? Is there a hierarchy of these categories that we have preferences in societies that we participate in? So I'm going to read a little bit more about what this actually is, not off the cuff, just from the article. And then we're going to open the floor up to some discussion. So, moral foundations theory was developed by a team of social and cultural psychologists, primarily Jonathan Haidt and Jesse Graham, to explore why, despite vast differences across cultures, morality has shared themes and similarities across populations. In essence, moral foundations theory suggests that there are several innate psychological systems at the core of our intuitive ethics. Cultures then build virtues, narratives, and institutions upon these foundational systems, resulting in the diverse moral beliefs we observe globally and even conflicts within nations. This model of human morality does not argue that all these systems are good. In other words, it is a descriptive account of human morality, not a normative one. Evolution does not care about the inherent goodness of psychological systems. Rather, it creates systems that maintain cooperation, promoting survival and reproduction. The original framework of moral foundations theory identified five foundations which are strongly supported by evidence across various cultures. The first foundation is care. This relates to our long evolution as mammals with attachment systems and an ability to feel and dislike the pain of others. It underlies the virtues of kindness, gentleness, and nurturance. Fairness. This foundation is related to the evolutionary process of reciprocal altruism. It underlies the virtue of justice and rights. Loyalty. This foundation is related to our long history as tribal creatures, able to form shifting coalitions. It is active anytime people feel that it's one for all and all for one. It underlies the virtues of patriotism and self-sacrifice for the group. Authority. This foundation was shaped by our long primate history of hierarchical social interactions. It underlies virtues of leadership and followership, including deference to prestigious authority figures and respect for traditions. And lastly, we have purity. This foundation was shaped by the psychology of disgust and contamination. It underlies notions of striving to live in an elevated, less carnal, more noble, and more natural way, often presented in religious narratives. This foundation underlies the widespread idea that the body is a temple that can be desecrated by immoral activities and contaminants, an idea not unique to religious traditions. It underlies the virtues of self-discipline, self-improvement, naturalness, and spirituality. Okay, so we'll stop there for a bit, and I think it's worth pointing out that if I just say fairness, you're probably not thinking about exactly what they're thinking about, but you are thinking about something that's related to justice and rights. If you think about care, you are thinking about something that's related to kindness and gentleness. So I think we can be a little bit off the cuff here. We don't have to be evolutionary psychologists to have a discussion about this. We can just talk about human beings in a society. We have these shared foundations for morality. Do we approve of those foundations? Do we disapprove of those foundations? is there a rank ordering system of the one that you're most concerned about? Let's start there.
Well, just to start off and trying to get more grasp on the theory itself, would the authors of this theory, the proponents of this of the theory, I know it's not a normative theory, obviously, but they would be basically arguing, from my understanding, that the six primary values are consistent and universal within the context of any given human society, within the context of even like pretty much any given human time. It's just like the balance in which we find them and the ways in which they're actually displayed vary. But I guess like their descriptive like processes, basically, like, these are six sort of value systems that we see consistently pop up across society. How those actually play out, interact with each other, show themselves within the context of a particular ethical environment can look very different, but they're there, which goes back into, like, you know, in previous episodes we talked about things like moral subjectivism and stuff like that. And that kind of, again, this sort of hints back to that point of like, while societies might ethically seem very different, their roots are all very similar. It's how we interpret, display, and sort of value individual values that becomes the more primary thing in terms of what our societies are actually going to look like.
Yeah, I think that the most important thing that we take away from this is the idea of we're looking to get towards intuitive ethics, and we're doing this through innate psychological systems. So care is an innate psychological system. If you were not able to care about other human beings as mammals, you wouldn't be a human being. You'd be something else. And so this is something innate to being a human being from the psychological perspective.
Like the innate psychological system of fairness would be related to, you could think back to like very early or even pre-humans, where it's like, you know, if we're in some sort of like group society, say hunter-gatherer or whatever, and there's never a like fair distribution of resources, right? Like say we all go on a hunt together, the five of us here, we go get a mammoth, and you know, and then suddenly Aaron, you're just like, yeah, but all this is mine, right? That's going to break down systems of cooperation that are really necessary for us to continue to be a functioning group as a whole.
And we can all see this innately. If any mammal behaved like this, it would be obvious that this is unfair. We don't have any disagreement about this, and we don't know this because of some inherent virtue in a religion or a cultural aspect. This is something that we have innately as human beings, psychologically. It's not the product of religion, it's not the product of society, it's not the product of something else. That's what they are arguing here. Something else that I think is really important is they are not claiming universal morality. They are very open to there being exceptions. So if there's one society out there that doesn't have care, and it's an outlier and it exists, that is fine. That doesn't break this theory at all. It allows for it. It's not, they don't believe in this is a replacement, or this is not an attempt to make a universalizable moral system. It is an attempt to make a descriptive system that covers what human being, the broadest possible aspects of human culture based on the information that we have.
Yeah, I mean, I would say like from listening to their descriptive theory, that while like obviously it's not normative, it's not really a position on what we should be doing, it's a position of how things actually are, obviously. But I would say that it's even in societies that would appear to be careless, for lack of a way of putting it, that can still be found with some level of consistency. I think that it's more, for me, interpreting, having like looked in, as you shared information on this for us before the show, for me, it would seem to be more that there's, realistically speaking, there's ways in which some societies just don't value those things very highly, right? Like, you know, we could go into all sorts of examples of like authoritarian, dictatorial, racist regimes or whatever. Obviously, like looking at those sorts of societies, they are going to involve some level of like care for the in-group or whatever, right? But clearly, like that's not a like prominent value within a system like that.
And do those societies survive because the people at the top are innately uncaring or innately caring? Or does that society survive because the majority of people in that society are caring regardless of the fact that they live under an authoritarian system? Hierarchical authority is not something we're a fan of. No one is happy as a child with having authority imposed on them, but that's incredibly necessary in order for them to learn the basic things of how to cooperate and that you can't always have your way. A very core psychological part of the human experience is learning that sometimes you have to listen to other people and you have to do what you're told. But most of the time, we really prefer not to. We prefer to be the one who is, if not telling other people what to do, having influence, having a voice, having choice in our discussion. Or at least that is how I think in Canada we frame this discussion. If we grew up in a different country, a more authoritarian country, it might be the case that we would say, like, you know, like, I don't have to listen to anyone, period, if I am the guy on top. That is the definition of being on top. I don't have to listen to anyone. Because we live in a democracy, representative democracy, we believe that the person in charge has an obligation to listen to all of Canada. Authority, it's needed in every human culture. But how we think about that authority, how we process that authority, and how we use it, and how we manage those hierarchical social relationships are still very different. And this theory isn't telling us how important it is. It is kind of interesting to me to think about, like, on the hierarchy of value, where do you want to put authority? Do you want to put it above care? Do you want to put it below care? Or does it go on the bottom?
In terms of the system of values, I'm always hesitant to create a kind of, like, although I think that there's ways in which we can interpret specific societies as having this kind of hierarchy, and that would become more like, obviously, going in the descriptive element. Looking at the more, like, conceptually, I'm always hesitant to make value judgments in terms of, like, the hierarchy of those values, just because I think there's something, maybe we can get it a little bit, but there's something almost counterproductive or counterintuitive to saying, like, you know, fairness is always going to be above authority, right? And it's also, I think, when looking at, like, any sort of system of values or moral system within the context of a real society, not just, like, conceptually, that sort of rigidity does not actually describe very well how people interact, live, and operate in the real world, whether that's in their personal relationships or in the context of the state or whatever it might be, right? Like, there's always going to be a lot more flexibility, which is why, like, for so many of us, ethics and all that kind of stuff is so interesting, because it's a tough thing to parse out.
To your point, too, about this idea of comparing or hierarchically arranging these values, I think that there's, in service of the descriptive project as well, I think if we are actually looking at the way that the values are put next to each other, and the fact that one of the, like, main, I guess, tasks of the ethicist is to try and find what values kind of win out in any given particular situation. And that kind of goes to show that there's a certain commensurability to these values. Sometimes in this situation, this value trumps this other value, you know. Sometimes honesty trumps bravery or something like that. You know, you really just got to get out of a situation or something. In this case, these are, like, I'm thinking of these foundations as, like, social values that we might hold as a whole, because this is supposed to be describing, like, intuitive moral systems. It's not really trying to describe, like, particular, it's not like an ethical particularism, really. But even still, we do really think that sometimes when we are recognizing authority, we understand that we are neglecting certain needs of society or something because of, like, a dire situation. The project of doing ethics is recognizing that the values might not all be, like, exactly the same. They might not all be equally of value. A certain society might have a tendency to value, like, authority or loyalty or purity. But at the same time, the fact that those can come into conflict means that they're commensurate in some way, is basically what I'm saying. So, again, to Hale's point of saying it's, you know, a hesitancy towards kind of ranking them, we can kind of, like, rank them relative to particular systems. So if we took one you know, what we understood to be one moral system and another, differences are going to arise, and it's going to make ranking them a lot easier. If we're just thinking about, you know, a intuitive Canadian morality, what that would look like, and it, the place of authority, I think in terms of political authority, we would not be particularly, I mean, we're, obviously we value it, it's a fundamental value, but we're not, I don't think we would be very comfortable placing it at number one. I'm thinking that's just political authority, though. I'm always kind of drawn to Plato's image of the ship of state, right? Which is basically an image for hierarchies of competence. So you have a ship and it's got all kinds of people on it. Do you want carpenters steering the ship? Do you want cartographers steering it? Do you want the baker steering it? No, you want the helmsman, you want the captain. We recognize authority through competence, through when there is a certain situation and a certain task needs to be done, we intuitively recognize the authority of the person who has the capacity to deal with that situation. So when we think of political authority, because politics does so much for society, it's really easy for what that political competency, what that looks like, fades into the background. But if you intuitively ask people, like, you know, who do you want to build your house? Well, you want a carpenter. You want a draftsman to build your house and design it. So I think Canadians do value it where it counts in that way. And also, too, going to, this is a, I think, I wonder what else this, if this would feed into something else, but this goes to show the interconnectedness of these. People find roles. They find their place in their society through being able to contribute to it. And they are conferred authority through that competence, right? You feel like a dignified and valued person because you make a contribution to society. And so in one way, I think intuitively we do value authority in that way, in the form of recognition.
And just to maybe, let's simplify our project here, because this is obviously rank ordering six things is not really possible in the constraints of time that we have here. So let's just simplify this to, if you had a society that made one of these its highest priority, what would be the potential problems of that? Let's start there. If you made a society where the highest pinnacle of morality was fairness, would that be a good society at the expense of the other five?
I feel like that's a counter intuitive to what moral foundations theory is trying to speak about. It's like, because it seems to be more about like the opposite of what a universal moral is, or Kantian ethics, where we have these categories and very strict borders between them. It seems that the moral theory is more about the psychological perspective and how each one integrates, and depending on the circumstance, and it's just very context-based. So I think that kind of gives it an injustice to say that if you were to do one, because that goes against what I think the moral theory is trying to say.
So what I'm saying is that we're not thinking about a society where only one is present and the five aren't present. We're thinking about a society where we're overemphasizing one de-emphasizing the others, but they would all still be present in the society.
So you could emphasize like care and harm, like most people would say, like I always say, you know, do not do undue harm, right? So I think that's something, but then you're almost losing like the point of what she's trying to say by that. So I think what they were trying to say more so is just that, like, in a society, what kind of traits do we want psychologically? And then therefore we're conditioned in a certain way, sheep per se for some people, because like she's really talking about the mixture between liberals and conservatives and how to change the political ideology. So I think that's maybe where you would get out of it. Like if you were to put one above the other, you would have ideals change.
Yep.
And it would be hard in a country like Canada.
And it is important that, again, they're not thinking about picking and choosing what morals are good. They're thinking about what morals are necessary to maintain cooperation and promote survival and reproduction. That is their That is the good they are concerned with in this case.
Yeah, but you're always going to have some imbalance, right? Because if the good, because obviously they're coming at it from an evolutionary psychology aspect, right? So you can actually bracket the discussion of, or the valuing of democracy even, and say look, that's not actually necessary for effectively the propagation and progress of the species, right? It's pretty easy to envision a society that's quite functional in many ways and successful, that really sets values of authoritarianism, or authority, I should say, it would be an authoritarian society, but authority and sanctity as primary, right? We could list off all sorts of they don't have to be super crazy examples, but really strong centralized states that are nationalist effectively. And there are all sorts of examples of relatively successful countries that operate in that kind of way. I don't necessarily think you have to be democratic, but if you're going to go down that route, as you're kind of mentioning, and really overemphasizing a couple values in your societal setup, then inevitably you are going to be, taking a significant loss in other areas, right? Obviously in that sort of society I'm talking about there, it could be highly successful in many ways, generally speaking, or the wider population. But obviously you're going to be sacrificing significant amounts of personal liberty to do that, mm-hmm. right? That's just, you're not going to be able to do that in that kind of society.
Yeah, and I think this is probably a good part to read a little bit further in the article, because there is more to this than just the five underlying values that they talk about. So in our original conception, the Fairness Foundation was skewed towards concerns about equality, which politically left-leaning individuals more strongly endorse in different cultures. In 2011, based on new data, we emphasized proportionality, which is often endorsed by everyone, but is slightly more strongly endorsed by politically right-leaning people. In 2023, based on a decade of empirical work, one of their teams decided to split the Fairness Foundation into equality and proportionality, making the case for six main foundations. So they split fairness into equality. In our theoretical reformulation, we defined equality as intuitions about equal treatment and equal outcome for individuals. And then proportionality, in their reformulation, we defined proportionality as intuitions about individuals getting rewarded in proportion to their merit or contribution. Since this was first described, the candidate foundations for which empirical evidence was strongest, we proposed five criteria for foundationhood. A, being common in third-party normative judgments. B, automatic effective evaluations. C, being culturally widespread, though not necessarily universal. D, evidence of innate preparedness. And E, a robust pre-existing evolutionary model. We think there are several very good candidates for foundationhood, especially liberty. This foundation is about feelings of reactance and resentment people feel towards those who dominate them and restrict their liberty. Its intuitions are often in tension with those of the Authority Foundation. The hatred of bullies and dominators motivates people to come together in solidarity to oppose or take down the oppressor. In 2012, we reported some preliminary work on this potential foundation on the psychology of libertarianism and liberty. The second one is honor. This foundation is about one's self-worth based on their reputation and assessment of what others think. In 2020, we made the case that honor can be an additional foundation wherein a man is expected to protect his kin and family, and under some circumstances be ready to violently and retaliate against anyone who insults his family's reputation. And the third one is ownership. So this foundation has been on the radar for moral psychologists for a long time, yet it remains one of the least studied constructs in this literature. In 2013, we maintained the importance of ownership as an additional foundation. Ownership intuitions are fast and is ubiquitous in human societies. Human intuitions about ownership have obvious parallels in other animals, and respect for property is an evolutionarily stable strategy. In 2023, we argued that ownership may meet the entire set of criteria to be an additional foundation. So obviously, they are not finished their studies. This is not a complete theory. What would be really interesting to talk about, if we had the expertise, would be to talk about the methodology that they're using to actually generate these foundations and evaluate them. But that's beyond the scope of our current discussion. And this is actually something that I was thinking about. So liberty, honor, and ownership. when I was thinking about these, I was like, I kind of think of those as being like secondary foundations, and I kind of see the first six as like being more primary. So liberty, honor, and ownership are not they're not yet foundations. They haven't been introduced yet.
Do you think that's because it doesn't like cause an empathetic reaction?
I think it's because it's harder to prove. Like, you can't prove it doesn't show up in societies in the same way that something like care shows up, or fairness shows up in society, or proportionality. Like, those things show up in society very, I think they're easier to psychologically prove, whereas liberty, honor, and ownership, I think, are harder to prove as foundations. I think there's more.
All I think about is the Freedom Rally when you say that, though, and like the, I guess, uprisings that happen when people feel that their liberty or power is being challenged.
Well, I mean, there are just uprisings that happen for other reasons as well, though. So it's like, couldn't we think of those uprisings that some people attribute to liberty being attributed to an abuse of loyalty? Like, we were loyal to you, you didn't give us what you want, so you betrayed that, we betray you, so on. Like do we need the idea of liberty to explain it, or can we just use a different moral foundation there? I think divorcing, and again, this is again very interconnected.
Liberty could be used in Quebec.
I think you'll have to expand on that a little bit. Like, you mean as a value?
Yeah.
Okay. So, which of these, so value for
their own like heritage and place in Canada?
I think that would be a lot to do with the original, the six foundations of sanctity, right? Like, sanctity is like the reverence for like traditional cultural practices and stuff like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, but I'm thinking like the normative, what goes on today, like the equalization payments that happen to go to Quebec, the you know, even like the social and psychological feeling when somebody that's from outside of Quebec goes to Quebec, you know. I think those things have a lot to do more with liberty, like their right to their own land, even though it's a part of Canada. It's a bigger topic for sure, but
well, I mean, there was a very literal attempt to dominate them in the past.
It just seems like for me, it sounds like they're almost prioritizing liberal point of views and then trying to contain the other point of views that could damage their.
So liberal in the political sense, they want to contain
the left. Yeah, like left leaning, what I think would be more of like the liberal, like power and honor and more stoic type values.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to make those kinds of category judgments because left and right, as they actually shift over time. Like, I have a book from the 1940s and it talks about how the liberals are for free trade and the conservatives are for protectionism. And over time, in different countries, like, policy landscape and the positions of parties changes dramatically based off of what's going on in the world. And so it's kind of hard to say that, like,
talking about like specific using the value foundations within descriptive processes now, like, we're obviously seeing a pretty radical shift in particularly in conservative politics. There is a significant shift, as you're talking about, when you would look at these various foundational values, from like the old school Republican Party to the current Trumpists. I mean, there's obviously a lot of similarities, but there's some pretty significant differences in terms of anti-authority. Like, it's a weird, there's a lot of weird stuff going on, but way more emphasis on like anti-authority, you know, sort of social revolution type stuff, which is very much like against the traditional Republican Party that we saw even like a decade ago, which was very traditionally conservative and stuff like that, right? So yeah, obviously these things like shift all the time back and forth, which is why even like it's always interesting, but a bit of a trap, I think, to the original authors talk quite specifically and explicitly about particularly the American context of like right and left and where these values fall. But again, like, that's problematic in and of itself, because we start to tend to think in that sort of like liberal conservative binary, when in reality, like, I actually agree that the way they parse this out as a descriptive model is relatively, like, it's quite interesting, and I think in many ways it's quite effective, but it's always going to, we're always dealing with some, with a certain degree of like temporality when we're placing them, the values on a kind of the binary scale, because they're always going to be shifting and moving. And there's all sorts, especially like we were talking earlier specifically, you know, and I'm sure some of the listeners are thinking